from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. After they shot two police officers in Las Vegas on Sunday, the killers draped a Don't Tread on Me flag and a swastika on one body. They pinned a note to the other. This is the beginning of the revolution, it said. The week before, anti-government, sovereign citizen adherent Dennis Marks was killed as he tried to lay siege to a Georgia courthouse. Last month, two state troopers shot in an anti-government household in Alaska. This hour, On Point, guns, rhetoric, dead police officers, and the anti-government movement in America. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What tips anti-government sentiment, rage, into open violence, and police officers, regular citizens, what do you see going on here? What do you fear? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. The two police officers in Las Vegas sitting in a pizza parlor having lunch, essentially assassinated as they sat in the booth at a press conference the day after. Police officers were shot dead. Las Vegas Assistant Sheriff Kevin McMahon said the killers, Jared and Amanda Miller, believed the government was the enemy.
I can tell you that there is no doubt that the suspects have some apparent ideology that's along the lines of militia and white supremacists. We don't necessarily believe that they are white supremacists or associated with the Nazi movement. We believe that they equate government and law enforcement fascism and those who support it with Nazis. In other words, they believe that law enforcement is the oppressor and they're associated with the Nazi movement.
They had rallied to the standoff at Clive and Bundy's ranch. This was just weeks before. Jared Miller conducted some video interviews of his own with other Bundy supporters who were there. This is the standoff between federal officials who wanted to collect the lease money on the land, Clive and Bundy, who wouldn't do it. There were plenty of heavily armed folks there, among them Jared Miller.
It is our freedom. They're taking it away inch by inch, and we need to stand up.
It doesn't matter what their excuse is.
Exactly.
They're taking our freedoms.
That's right. That's right. And we need to fight, America. We need to fight.
Jared and Amanda Miller now dead, but two police and one more Las Vegas citizen dead as well in that shootout on Sunday. Connor Schein joins us right now, reporter for the Las Vegas Sun. Connor, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
Just to recall this, I mean, it started in the pizza parlor, then across the street to the Walmart. I think you had police coming in from the front and back, some of them tracking the Millers as they ran around Walmart over the security of the security video cameras to try and corner them there before they took their own lives.
Yes, and we actually found out yesterday that police fired the fatal shot that killed Jared Miller. They had were chased sort of to the back of the store by officers. They were pinned from the front and the back, and they apparently used some of the items they found in the store to build a defensive position back there, but surrounded. Jared Miller was shot, killed, and then Amanda ended up taking her own life.
We had heard earlier that she had killed him and then taken her own life.
Yes, that was what was initially reported, and in my understanding, she still shot him, but the fatal shot was fired by police.
Police officers, they're very clear in their press conference after the killings that this is related to a whole body of anti-government thinking. Just remind us of the symbols that were left behind and what they are believed to have stood for.
Yeah, so they left several things after shooting the two officers at the police, the pizza parlor. The first was a swastika. That one's a little unclear. Like the police said, they're not believed to be linked to white supremacist groups, but they apparently equated the U.S. government with the government of Nazi Germany. The second was a Gadsden flag, which is the Don't Tread on Me flag, which has become sort of a popular symbol of the sort of the patriot movement. And then finally, they left a note pinned to one of the officers, too, that made reference to the beginning of a revolution.
And what's the revolution? From subsequently, people opened up all these Facebook pages and began reading about all that they had posted. What have you learned there, Connor?
Yeah, it's the revolution talk, it seems to kind of have come around recently in the last month or so. His posts, especially after the Clive and Bundy, he was kicked off the ranch. His posts seemed to take on a little more fervor, and they began to reference violence. Before that, there were still very many troubling posts venting against a government that he saw as tyrannical. He saw it as unfair. He had a lot of run-ins with the law, so that's probably contributed to part of it. A lot of guns rights, you know, right-wing kind of posts that you would see on his Facebook, his Google+, his YouTube page also had several videos of him spouting sort of his twisted version of politics as he saw it.
They had come heavily armed, a backpack full of ammunition, and they took the police guns as well. How many rounds did they have by the time they finished shooting the police and got to Walmart?
I don't know the exact number. I know they came armed with several hundred rounds of ammo, and it does not sound like they fired, in, you know, they could not, you know, fired anywhere near that amount. So they were well armed. They walked nearly 5 miles from their downtown apartment. They left very early in the morning, around 4:30 a.m., walked for several hours on what was a very hot day in Las Vegas with all that gear and ammunition.
I mean, these were one-time performance artists. We see images of them dressed like the Joker from Batman movies here. But what about as the police take this on board? And it must be a lousy feeling. These guys are just at a pizza buffet, and the next thing you know, they're dead. What are you hearing from law enforcement in Las Vegas about the political thinking behind this killing and what kind of threat it represents?
It's something I think law enforcement here, they live with a certain amount of threat on their job every level. I don't think any of them expect to be ambushed when they're eating lunch like this, but they know that it is a dangerous job, and that's what they sign up with. As you might imagine, our police force has been devastated by this. It's hit everybody. We have several police departments in the region. It's been a very tough time for all of them. They've doubled up police officers and patrols for the time being to ensure their safety. Beyond that, I don't know if our law enforcement has seen it explicitly, but across the country there has been a rise that has been tracked by several groups in the number of extremist kind of motivated attacks on law enforcement officers over the last 5 or so years. There's been about 40 since 2009.
Connor, what's the public response been there? I mean, I've seen this pair described as the wingnut Bonnie and Clyde online, but in general, how's the public responded to what happened?
As you imagine, they're pretty shocked. You know, we hear far too often about these sorts of mass shootings in other parts of the country, but it's different when it hits your home. And I think a lot of people are shocked. You know, they see the police and to think that someone could do something so brazen, you know, an execution style shooting on a Sunday morning. People just aren't really sure what to make of that.
Connor Shine with the Las Vegas Sun joining us from Las Vegas, Nevada. Connor, thanks very much for being with us.
Yeah, thank you.
Here again from the press conference describing what happened. The police officers, two now dead, sitting eating lunch in Las Vegas. Here it is.
These crooks are scared of men and women who have honor in their hearts and who want freedom. And we're being listed as the terrorist. I am listed as someone who wants violence and a revolution on MSNBC and CNN. Because I tell them, I know you're preparing for war with us, and if you try it, 1776 will commence again. Those aren't just words. We're taking action.
Okay, that wasn't the tape I expected, but that gives you a sense of some of the talk, the rhetoric, the thinking in that big school of thought, that big growing community that is vividly anti-government. That was conservative radio host Alex Jones on his show in February. This was in a segment on guns. He called law enforcement agencies crooks, warned, of, as you heard there, of a coming war, said these aren't just words. Well, in Las Vegas on Sunday, they were not. With us right now from Las Vegas, Robert Futrell, professor and chair of the sociology department at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Does a lot of research on the U.S. white power mobilization movement. Robert Futrell, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
We're going to go in just a minute to a police officer who's followed this very closely. But what's your sense of how these Sunday killings in your city, Las Vegas, fit in to a national picture, if they do, of anti-government sentiment, rhetoric, thinking, and here, violent action?
Right. Well, the killings in Las Vegas were done apparently by some lone wolves, but this is increasingly common. But they're done based on a set of ideas that are prevalent and easily accessible both in mainstream or semi-mainstream media, among politicians, radio talk show hosts, television talk show hosts, and even more accessible through the internet. There's a bit of a feedback factor and a legitimation factor when we hear this talk on the radio, and that sort of develops these conspiracy theories and all the ideological worries that we see someone like Jared Miller spouting. These folks believe that in a number of conspiracies, the federal government has been corrupted, now controlled by a cabal of bankers, international agencies, and the political elite that they refer to as the shadow government or the New World Order. They're scared of gun restrictions and seizures by federal agents. The NRA's Wayne LaPierre once called federal agents jackbooted thugs. They talk about death camps and concentration camps. They are worried about immigration issues, and that feeds into racism and homophobia. And we have seen a spike in anti-government, patriot militia groups in the last few years. And so to see these folks come out and engage in some of the horrific activities of which Jared Miller and his wife Amanda's actions were part of, it is only one piece of this larger picture.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Las Vegas police shooting and the Don't Tread on Me anti-government movement in America, where it verges into violence. Robert Futrell joins us from Las Vegas, professor of sociology, University of Nevada, Las Vegas. He's watching all this very closely. Police officers in Las Vegas saw it firsthand. Here, once again, them describing the scene where these two officers were essentially assassinated as they sat in a booth at a pizza buffet.
The suspects pulled the officers out of the booth and onto the ground, where they placed a Gadsden flag, which is a Don't Tread on Me yellow flag, on the body of Officer Beck. They also threw a swastika on top of his body. At that point, Mr. Jared Miller then pinned a note to Officer Saldo that basically stated that this is the beginning of the revolution.
And then on to Walmart, more killing, more death. Somebody standing in line there tried to stop them, pulled his gun, he was shot. They ended up dead themselves. It's not the only place this has been going on. Just last week, a member of the so-called Sovereign Citizens Movement named Dennis Marks, who also had worked for the federal government, the TSA, attacked a courthouse in Cumming, Georgia, armed with guns and explosives. He planned, it appears, to lay siege and take hostages there, but was killed by a sheriff's deputy. Here was a CBS News report last week on Marks's last stand.
The attacker had driven that silver SUV close to the front door, driving toward and nearly running over a deputy. He began firing and detonated smoke bombs. One deputy was shot during the battle.
And it could have been much worse. Robert Futrell, standby in Las Vegas. With us right now from Greensboro, North Carolina, is Detective Corey Flowers, criminal intelligence detective with the Greensboro Police Department, expert on anti-government, other similar movements. He and his colleague, Detective Rob Finch, created a training program 3 years ago for law enforcement around the country on how to deal with the threats posed by sovereign citizens, so-called, and other groups. They also advise judges, district attorneys, legislators. Corey Flowers, Detective Flowers, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks for the invitation.
How much of this kind of activity is going on out there? I mean, it's one thing to hang out in chat rooms, but how much is going on where it verges toward violence, Corey?
Sure. What we've seen is a rather dramatic increase, especially with the sovereign citizen anti-government wing of these subversive groups, especially since the 2008, whatever you like to call it, recession, decline in the economy, truly spiked an increase in overall vitriol from these groups, which has led to some violence.
Some violence. We're hearing about 40-plus incidents either carried out or attempted in the last couple of years. Is this something that is on police department radar screens commonly now, Detective Flowers?
Certainly it is. And when we hear about things such as the, what we would term as just the senseless killing of our two brother officers in Las Vegas, it definitely reminds us that not only is this type of chatter online and the vitriol is spewed online, but once this kind of nonsense is broadcast via the internet, folks all over the country and all over the planet can not only tune into that, but it can fuel the smaller percentage of folks who are actually inclined to physical violence. That's the problem. These kind of ideas have been around for, you know, since any established governments have existed. There have been folks that have been displeased with the government. The problem now with the advent of the internet and the internet's wide availability is that now not only can you just communicate with your small individuals, but you can have a gigantic sphere of influence via podcasts, microblogs, social media, social networking, that can truly project your voice well beyond anything that was imagined, say, 20 years ago.
Robert Futrell, you referenced this from Las Vegas a couple of minutes ago, but maybe we are really in a different world now, when that echo chamber and magnification of the internet is so immediate and so widespread. How does that change the kind of drumbeat that goes in these movements, the way these things are communicated, and maybe even the way people end up acting?
Well, Detective Flowers is absolutely right. The internet has been an enormous boon to these movements, specifically thinking about the white power movement, which is what my research has been on. You know, the internet allows people to connect with others like them. And as Detective Flowers said, it's not only do you connect with people in your local community that you see them face to face, but now you imagine a worldwide movement, a worldwide grouping of people who think in the same ways as you. For someone like Jared Miller, what you also have is the ability to broadcast your own thoughts, which suggests that everyone has a pulpit. And to the people broadcasting those thoughts, I think it conveys a sense of power to them to be able to talk to others. And they imagine talking to, you know, many, many others about their thoughts and having those thoughts affirmed and cultivated and reaffirmed over time. So in sociology, we call this developing a collective identity, a sense of we-ness and fellow feeling with others, which was very hard to do for very marginalized groups like white power movement or mm-hmm. the anti-government movement prior to the internet.
But not so hard to do today, and there can be a kind of certainly for the thinking, cheerleading that goes on and defending on bigger media as well. The FBI issued a bulletin about 2 years ago, headlined Sovereign Citizens, a Growing Domestic Threat to Law Enforcement. On his TV show, Blaze TV, on Blaze TV, Glenn Beck took to the air mocking that warning. He called it a government setup to keep tabs on conservative Americans. Sure, there are a few kooks out there, he said, in the Sovereign Citizens movement.
Are these guys a concern? Maybe, I don't know, maybe there's one crackpot there that's going to do, you know, something, maybe. But you've got a whole buttload of crackpots on the streets right now, and some of them are hanging around the president of the United States. This, I believe, allows the government to start cracking down on all types of extremists. Religious extremists, not Muslim extremists, just religious extremists. Small government extremists, you know, the kind that want small government.
Glenn Beck there on Sovereign Citizens. We'll look at that movement. In April, the Las Vegas police killers, Jared and Amanda Miller, joined the armed standoff as anti-government protester at anti-government protester Clive and Bundy's cattle ranch. They were eventually thrown off the ranch by the Bundys. But before they were, local TV crews spoke to Jared. His words for federal agents, watch out.
I feel sorry for any federal agents that want to come in here and try to push us around or anything like that. I really don't want violence toward them, but if they're going to come bring violence to us, well, if that's the language they want to speak, we'll learn it.
Sounds like it was learned. Weeks later, dead police in Las Vegas. Detective Corey Flowers, we heard Glenn Beck there talking about saying maybe there's one crackpot out there that's going to do something. One crackpot. What are you seeing in terms of how widespread the, you know, itchy trigger fingers may be in this movement, Corey?
Right, Tom, and I tell you that when I hear when I hear Jared Miller's quote there, it is so eerily reminiscent of another individual named Jerry Kane, who in 2010, in February 2010, assassinated two police officers in West Memphis, Arkansas. Made the same quote well beforehand to a crowd of individuals at a sovereign redemption scam type seminar. He said, I don't want to have to kill anybody, but if they keep messing with me, quote, that's what's going to have to come out. Those were his words on the video recording. We have to start taking folks at their word. When these folks are leaking their intentions. They're projecting their intentions online or in audible speech. We have to take these things more seriously because it is becoming prevalent. It's becoming much more prevalent. And then you get the spotlight of the media covering these folks and making them, you know, 15-minute celebrities. It's very alluring to these individuals who are already off kilter anyway, left or right of center.
Detective Flowers, what does the Sovereign Citizens Movement teach? What's its ideology, its thinking?
Sure. As I generally explain it, the grave and vast difference between a common, you know, criminal, we'll call a common criminal, you know, murderer, rapist, robber, they may dislike authority because they understand and realize that the governing authority has legitimate power to punish them, right, via the courts, via jails. The sovereign movement is completely, completely a different base because these guys start at a point that we dislike the government. Not because we fear your viable, legitimate authority, but because we don't believe you have any authority over us. And that's a very, very different place to stand. So the idea of a police officer dealing with, a hardcore sovereign citizen with, you know, wearing a uniform, with the shiny badge, police car with decals and blue lights, none of that matters to these individuals. They don't see the governing body, you know, the state of Louisiana, the Forsyth County of Georgia. They don't see any of that as viable, and that's a dangerous, dangerous place to stand. It leaves very, very little room for, you know, for reasoning and rationale.
Here's a report from, you mentioned it, 2010, two West Memphis police officers shot and killed after pulling over a father and son who considered themselves part of the Sovereign Citizen Movement. Here's local news channel WPTY's Joyce Peterson reporting on what motivated the father and son.
Jerry Kane and his son Joseph hated the U.S. government. They did not respect it, didn't think the same laws that apply to you and to me applied to them. They had very particular beliefs and habits, like thinking they did not need driver's licenses. When those beliefs came into conflict with officers Powdert and Evans yesterday, it was the perfect storm.
And down went the police officers. Detective Flowers, what do you teach police to watch out for here? How do they know when this is in their environment?
Yeah, and this is the rub, Tom. And this is the great part about our country is that, you know, you can believe anything. You can have all kinds of maniacal thoughts. Only when those thoughts cross the line into either criminal conspiracies or criminal acts do they become criminal. And that's the beautiful and the dangerous part about the United States. We love those freedoms. We basically teach a one-day class, two-day class for law enforcement, judges, tax collectors, district attorneys, anyone on this side of the government that may encounter sovereigns. We just teach them how to recognize that someone is espousing sovereign ideology. We teach them buzzwords. We teach them things to listen for. We teach them how to scan paperwork that may be submitted to determine if you're dealing with a sovereign. And again, even upon realizing that, we understand that only 2, maybe 5% of sovereign citizens, self-espoused sovereigns, are going to become physically violent. But we don't, you know, we want folks to recognize it first and then take appropriate actions, then be able to ask the questions and do the follow-up. That's the idea.
What's going to surprise police in that circumstance? I mean, we just saw two state troopers killed in Alaska. These were kind of well-known. They were on a National Geographic show. Many have seen it about, you know, state troopers out in the bush, in the field in Alaska. They went into a household, a domestic dispute over a sofa, over a couch, and start arguing with the father. 19-year-old son comes out, sovereign citizen thinking in the house, and next thing you know, they're both dead. Where does the surprise factor come in?
Well, the surprise factor is this, and again, it's all about, you know, it's the double-edged sword of democracy. We love the freedoms. Our officers, good police officers all across this country, you know, when they encounter, say, a sovereign on the side of the road, with Joe and Jerry Kane in May 2010, they stopped the van with the two cop killers in the van. Jerry Kane exited the van and handed Brandon Powdert a pack, a plethora of paperwork, all sovereign documentation, and he began claiming things like, I have diplomatic immunity, right? I'm a diplomat. Yammering these kind of things, police officers, again, you know, not wanting to trample on anyone's civil rights. If I'm dealing with a real diplomat, I'm going to deal with him appropriately, okay? So we give folks the benefit of the doubt because we're, you know, professional peace officers. We want to treat you as the way that you know, your status deserves as a diplomat. In the meantime, the son, the 16-year-old son, Joe Kane, is in the front passenger seat creating an ambush. He opened and breached the door and held it of the van. He charged an AK-47, and he came out and shot those two officers with 26 rounds from a 7.62 assault rifle, which is utterly devastating. That's the problem. You know, we don't deal with folks KGB style. If we did, it would be absolutely safer for us, but that's not democracy.
Detective Flowers, please stand by. Robert Futrell in Las Vegas with us right now from Tallahassee, Florida. Robert Harris, Senior Research Associate at the Institute for Intergovernmental Research, is a nonprofit, provides research and tech assistance to law enforcement around the country. Robert Harris, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
What's the prevalence of this thinking, the prevalence of people prepared to act on this thinking, act violently, Robert Harris?
When we look at anti-government extremists, it's a radicalization process. As Detective Flower said, the vast majority of these people are typically not going to be violent. But unfortunately for law enforcement officers, they don't know what other stressors or what other social triggers have occurred in this person's life prior to their initial contact. And for that person, in many cases, today is the day that they've had enough from the government and they're going to strike back.
What are you telling police departments around the country? Is there enough of this that they need to be a little attuned, a lot attuned? You know, how does the threat of this compare to all the other threats that they talk about? Criminal, terrorism originating abroad?
Well, certainly all of those factors come into play. The Bureau of Justice Assistance is very strongly supportive of training police officers in a wide variety of topics. For instance, the Bureau of Justice Assistance state and local anti-terrorism training focuses on training programs for both domestic extremism and extremist ideologies coming from other countries. And the Bureau of Justice Assistance Valor Program stresses officer safety initiatives to provide officers with the tools they need to recognize a threat and survive the threat should it appear.
What's the bigger threat day to day, foreign or domestic?
I think a lot of that might be jurisdictional in nature. If you have high-value targets, say, for example, like New York City, they may view international threats as more of a perceived threat in their particular area. And other parts of the country, I think we're seeing a spike of increase from the anti-government extremists. We've seen their numbers increasing. It's a very fractionalized movement. There are no charismatic leaders. And they spike up maybe 1, 2, 4, 5 people. And in many cases, they're just lone individuals. They develop their ideology through the internet, through social media. And this anti-government extremism just tends to explode at a particular point on contact with an officer.
Robert Harris with the Institute for Intergovernmental Research in Tallahassee. Thanks so much for being with us, Mr. Harris.
Thank you.
Robert Futrell, no charismatic leaders? Really?
Well, there are representatives, and they have a voice, and primarily the internet is where the most extreme voices are. But Mr. Harris is right. I mean, this is essentially leaderless resistance. These are decentralized networks. There's a lot of overlapping participation among the various groups, or to even call them groups is very difficult among these networks.
What about the very vivid talk radio voices that we hear? For that matter, you raised Wayne LaPierre at the NRA earlier.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's right. And I think, from some institutionalized mainstream politicians, news anchors, TV, radio, talk show hosts, they certainly fuel the fire and provide a legitimation factor, as do some fairly recent legislative acts. The recent Indiana law, for instance, is the first in the U.S. to specifically allow force against police officers under circumstances that are vaguely defined as unlawful intrusion by a public servant to protect themselves. These ideas get refiltered through internet blogs, and the perceived affinities and alignments are there. It creates the broader culture and from which the violence springs.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Las Vegas police shooting and the Don't Tread on Me anti-government movement in America. Two policemen dead in Las Vegas on Sunday, assassinated essentially as they sat eating lunch in a pizza parlor. The killers, Jared and Amanda Miller, had been very active online talking up the anti-government kind of movement. We want peace, but we're ready for war, writing that kind of thing. And on this day, with a backpack full of ammunition, they acted. Then across the street to Walmart, ready to say, this is revolution, ready to kill some more. They ended up dead themselves. Detective Corey Flowers is with us from the Greensboro Police Department, specializes in looking at and training for this kind of issue, this kind of threat in this country for police and more. Robert Futrella is with us from the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, professor, chair of the sociology department there, pays a lot of attention to the white power movement mobilization in this country. Just the voice of the movement a little more here. Nebraska Educational Television interviewed Paul Hansen and identifies himself as a quote-unquote free inhabitant, not connected with any violent action, but the right to bear arms is important to members of the sovereign citizens movement, he says, and it's not for hunting deer.
It's not for hunting, and it's not for keeping criminals off your yard. It was primarily put in that if a government ever goes bad, you have a chance.
A chance. And on Sunday, that was the message, the Don't Tread on Me flag left on the body of the policeman. Harry in Madison, Wisconsin. Harry, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I lived in Kansas before I moved to Madison, and I lived there during the early 90s, and it's like this is like deja vu for me. I lived in the county where Terry Nichols and Tim McVeigh basically lived prior to building their bomb and then going down to Oklahoma City. And I can tell you, living in that community, you kind of got this thing through the bumper sticker politic, and you could see this building over time. Now, and this is very ironic, and I think there are enablers and leaders that are actually elected officials, and I would point to Congressman Tim Huelskamp, who is the representative for that district in Kansas where that event happened.
That's a pretty serious charge. Why would you point at Congressman Huelskamp?
Go to April 21st, 2014, Congressman Huelskamp's newsletter, and look down under his Easter message, Government by Force. And in that, he has a little tome about where he hooks up Cliven Bundy's standoff mm-hmm. to the Endangered Species Act and government overreach, and how they were having to defend themselves against the overreach of the federal government and these military-type actions against citizens. And, I mean, this is, to me, the message is pretty clear, you know. And, you know, you have this out in the countryside of people being represented by those that kind of fan the flames, you know, of the government's out to get you, you know, and all this. And we saw it after Waco, but we didn't have elected officials at that point. Now we have this new dynamic that I think is very, very dangerous.
I appreciate your call, Harry. Robert Futrell, it is a pretty hot brew out there. You look on the Internet and well beyond now. We saw it at the Cliven Bundy Ranch, and we certainly saw it Sunday. We've seen it in these dozens of incidents over the last few years. I mean, do we have, again, in this country, an elevated platform or fever from which people may jump off into actual violent action? Robert, how do you see it?
Well, the numbers certainly suggest that. The Southern Poverty Law Center has identified more than 1,000 anti-government and patriot militia groups that were active in 2013. There are now more conspiracy-minded patriot groups than at the height of the militia movement in the 1990s, and it's important that your caller mentioned the 90s and Oklahoma City bombing and Waco and Ruby Ridge could be pulled into that as well.
Mm-hmm. Of course, Oklahoma, 168 dead in that bombing in Oklahoma. This is serious business, or was.
That's right, and it only takes a few, and that's the worry. It only takes a few to create a horrific situation. What's very interesting is that the militia movement declined in participation after the Oklahoma City bombing, which suggests that many in that movement saw the actions of Timothy McVeigh as stepping over the line. At the time, there was a domestic terrorism panel that was established after the Oklahoma City bombing to try to consider what the domestic threat was. That domestic terrorism panel was decommissioned after 9/11, and we began to look at external threats. That panel was recommissioned by Attorney General Eric Holder, I think, just last week, sort of acknowledging that the threat of domestic violence, domestic terror in the United States has been on the rise and something we should consider more clearly.
Let me go to Brandon in Mobile, Alabama. Brandon, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My comment is I kind of understand where these shooters have come from, And I believe it's due to the insensitive and militaristic tactics that the police departments across America use these days. You could have a bad day, you know, argument with wife, financial stress, get pulled over, get into an argument with a police officer, and they'll yank you out, you know, could beat you to death or shoot you if you make the wrong move. It happens every day. People with mental disabilities that need to go to a hospital, and the first and the police are the first ones to make contact, and they end up shooting them and killing them, and that causes resentment. And under the Obama administration, he is arming police departments across America with military hardware, and it's scary. And that's and people aren't want to get going to give their guns up under gun control because they're scared of the government.
But Brandon, is it fair to put a "Don't Tread on Me" flag down on the body of a policeman eating pizza for lunch to throw down a swastika, apparently signifying that equating the police department with Nazis in this country?
Well, I don't believe about the whole Nazi symbol and that the whole "Don't Tread on Me." Police tread on American citizens every day. They violate their rights. And all it is, they'll say it's departmental procedures, and that's it.
Brandon, I appreciate your call from Mobile. Thank you very much. Let me take it to Detective Flowers. What about that perspective, Corey Flowers, that, it's been rough out there. There's a lot of tension. There's plenty of people who perhaps, as Brandon says, should be getting mental health assistance who instead are on the street. People have economic problems. They run into the police. They've got frustrations. Things get tense in a hurry. Brandon sees police overreach and a response to that.
Sure. Tom, I appreciate everyone's different levels of sensitivities, and I completely appreciate Brandon's opinion. I'm sure it comes from a very pointed set of experiences, as we all do. The problem is this, a couple of the grander problems is that any of these incidents are so magnified by the mass media that it seems to look like that is happening all the time. Sure. You see, one corrupt police officer on the other side of the country, gets indicted. Now it's all over every major news media from here, from sea to shining sea. It gets magnified like anything else on the open internet, and it appears to, especially to folks that may have experienced a set of experiences like Brandon's, that this is rampant. As a 15-year police officer, as myself, I can say, in any business, in any situation, in any corporation, in any department, in any military, sure, you're going to have folks that do the wrong thing. That's just human nature. Folks that make bad decisions. But I can tell you from, my 2 cents and my experience training police officers literally all over this country that, 95-98% of these police officers, sign up to do a job that they know is inherently dangerous, to be that thin dividing line between society, good civil society, and evil chaos. And they do it not for pay. They do it not for, to become famous or win medals, but because they're noble individuals. And sure, there are bad eggs in any corporation. But I think your point to Brandon of, resisting a false arrest, right, is completely a different ballpark from ambushing two officers who are eating in a diner. It's just that's an evil act. There's no other way to tag that.
And the rhetoric out there, just hot as it can be, the three percenters group, Mike Vandenberg, the homepage warning all politics in this country now is just dress rehearsal for civil war. With all the guns in this country, that is not something that people really want to hear. Alex Jones, we heard a little bit of him earlier, but I didn't introduce it properly. It was from his show in February, his segment on guns, where he was calling law enforcement agencies crooks, warning of a coming war. When, listen to this again. We heard no charismatic leaders, but I'm not sure about that when you hear Alex Jones here. He later will talk about this. He came back after the Sunday killings and said that the cop killings in Las Vegas were staged by Harry Reid. Here's Alex Jones in February.
These crooks are scared of men and women who have honor in their hearts and who want freedom. And we're being listed as the terrorist. I am listed as someone who wants violence and a revolution on MSNBC and CNN. Because I tell them, I know you're preparing for war with us, and if you try it, 1776 will commence again. Those aren't just words. We're taking action.
Robert Futrell, I don't know about leader, but that certainly falls in the category of charismatic or at least demagogic.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, this is all part of the larger picture. I mean, what you see here is rising levels of hatred and paranoia, the easy availability of guns, culture of violence in which shooting someone seems perfectly acceptable as a resolution to many problems in the minds of many. It's all like piling up containers of gasoline in a closed garage and then blissfully engaging in arc welding or something. You can expect these things to happen. And while we should be horrified when they do, I don't think we should be surprised because there's a culture that is fomenting and seeding the acts that then we see happening. And the Millers are just one example of this.
Pam in Madison, Wisconsin. Thank you for calling, Pam. You're on the air.
Hi. My main question is, why isn't this considered anarchy at some point? We're calling it sovereign behavior as a kind of politically correct term, when it's really anarchical behavior. Anti-government is anarchy.
Yeah, Pam, let me pick that up, and I want to make it clear. When we say sovereign citizen, we're not using that as a kind of general modifier or description here. That is the name of a movement. Pam would just call it anarchy, but Corey, clarify for us. The sovereign citizen movement, this isn't – I'm not using this as my modifier for these people. This is a self-described tag that they take.
Sure, and I like to be very specific. Anarchism as a political discourse or as a political philosophy harks back to the Haymarket Affair in Chicago, May 1st, 1886. There was a pro-union basically became a riot. All police mm-hmm. officers were killed, and that has become a an official May Day, May 1 every year is a big deal for true anarchists. Anarchism at its base, literally meaning no government, no authority, and no union. Right, as long as I'm not infringing on your rights or your rights, I should be able to do anything I want. The sovereign citizen movement, specifically, while there is no gigantic group that you have to sign on to, it is a very clear, delineated political ideology that is rooted in historical facts that if you talk to a sovereign citizen in Alaska or one in North Carolina or one in Texas and interviewed them individually, they would tell you a lot of the same thing.
And they don't recognize government authority.
Correct, exactly. As it exists today, some of the individuals, some sovereigns will harken back to pre-14th Amendment days when all U.S. citizens were officially named as federal U.S. citizens, and they have a big hang-up, big problem with the 14th Amendment. It's not true anarchy. Right.
Bill in Northborough, Massachusetts. Bill, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Finally, you had a caller, the previous caller, with half a brain who finally put her finger on the problem. These people have no right to do anything. No one deputized them. No one elected them. They have no authority. They have no constitutional authority. When Clive Bundy pulled that stunt, the government should have stepped right in, right then and there, confronted these people, came in with absolute force and said, surrender your weapons, come out with your hands up. And if they didn't, they should have gone in with guns blazing, if necessary, and taken these people down and demonstrated to all the other gun nuts out there, don't pull this crap again, or this is exactly what you could have expected. They didn't, and now all these groups are going to pull this crap again and again and again.
Bill, we've got it. I don't think it started from standstill by any means, and I'm sure you don't either, at Clive and Bundy's ranch. But I do wonder, Robert Futrell, about that. I mean, these killers of the police over the weekend, the Millers were there with a cooler, I read here, full of ammunition. Why didn't authorities come in there when there was clear armed defiance and broken law?
Well, I think history has something to say to this. The Waco incident, the Ruby Ridge incident, I think is hot on the minds of and the worry about what happens when one would confront an armed group of still citizens. I mean, they still are citizens.
Yeah, and Waco seen as overkill in retrospect after all the fire and death there.
That's right. That's right. And also, I don't think they wanted any deaths. And so the federal agents for the BLM pulled out to avoid that because at any moment, from what I understand, at any moment they were concerned that someone, perhaps like a Jared Miller, would fire a shot. And at that moment, people would die.
And they well could have. Corey Flowers, where do you see this going? Are we, when and if the economy improves, do we turn the corner on this, or are we building a base of internet rhetoric that keeps this coming, maybe grows?
Sure. I don't see, Tom, I don't see any decrease in the near future for a couple of reasons. You know, so we pose a lot of problems. You know, let me give you my 2 cents on, mm-hmm. on something we possibly can do to maybe make it different. We need to, I would say, law enforcement, especially the larger agencies, need to dedicate and devote some detectives to paying attention to what their jurisdiction citizens are saying online. These folks are leaking and projecting and advertising their intentions online very clearly. Incidents from Jared Loughner to even back as far as Dylan Klebold and Eric Harris in Columbine High School in Littleton, Colorado. Mm-hmm. They built seminal hit lists and put them online in the early days of the internet. James Von Brunn, who assassinated the security guard at the Holocaust Museum, he was advertising online. Justin Moose, Anders Breivik in Sweden. So we need to pay attention to those indicators online. If the media would also voluntarily choose to agree to blackout so much mass coverage of these incidents, I think it would also decrease.
That's a tall order right there, but pay attention. The message from Corey Flowers. Of course, there's so much to pay attention to. Overwhelming sometimes. Detective Corey Flowers in Greensboro, North Carolina, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
And Robert Futrell in Las Vegas. Thank you, Professor Futrell.
Thanks, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.